Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 3:06 on a Friday afternoon. We're coming to you, as always, live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting, and hope you're listening around the state of Georgia. Our Twitter handle is at PoliticsGPB. We want to hear from you. That's the way you can join in the conversation throughout the show today. Who won the Republican debate last night? If anyone did, our panelists will weigh in on that, but you should tell us your thoughts as well. With me in the studio today, Jim Galloway. He is the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He edits Political Insider, the daily blog that gives you everything you need to know, hour by hour in politics, state, national, and local. Beth Shapiro, she is now a retired Democratic pollster and consultant, but she could not resist continuing to be a part of Political Rewind, and we're the luckier for the fact that she wants to join us. And we're glad to welcome back one of Jim Galloway's colleagues at the AJC, Kyle Wingfield. By the way, you read Jim Galloway in the Dead Tree edition on Thursdays and Sundays, and Kyle Wingfield
the same
on the same dates. Okay, it's great to have you all here. We're going to start the show a little bit differently this week. You know, I was never really aware. I sort of had this vague awareness that there is a huge gambling market around political campaigns. I mean, I knew it was out there, and I know that there are many people who believe that it is those markets which in some ways are the most reliable predictors of election outcomes. We're joined on the phone by Paul Krishnamurti. He is also known, by the way, as the political gambler. He was the chief analyst for the world's biggest betting exchange, Betfair.com, and he has been making a living setting odds for political races in the UK. He came to the United States in 2008 to watch the Obama campaign unfold, and he's back now in one of what is clearly the most exciting presidential campaign we've ever seen. Paul, are you on the phone with us?
I am. Hello. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. Let me start by asking you a real basic question. How much money is there in the political betting field right now?
Incredible amounts. So over the course of this year, there will be hundreds of billions traded on the U.S. presidential election across various markets.
Okay, Paul, we're having some significant audio problems in hearing you, so let's keep talking and hope that we can clear them up as we go. So it's obviously a huge world of gambling around political campaigns right now.
Yeah.
So how often do you set odds? For instance, after that raucous GOP debate last night, which our panel will discuss in a little while, do you go in and analyze what happened last night and recalculate odds, watch what the gamblers are doing? How does that work?
Okay, so the market is no one is specifically setting the odds. It's like eBay or another peer-to-peer exchange where the market, the odds are set by supply and demand.
Hey, Paul, we're going to try. Paul, we've got to interrupt you because we're really having a very hard time here. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to try to call you back and hope that we can get a better connection. So stay with us. Thanks.
Thanks.
Panel, I had no idea the markets for gambling around politics were as big as he describes,
or that live radio was so exciting.
I don't know what you may be on a cell phone in a bad cell. I really don't know, but we'll try to get him back.
Does any of this gambling take place at Trump casinos?
Are there any left?
I don't know. I'm going to refresh my degree from Trump University, and I'll investigate that for you.
All right. So let me do this while we're trying to reestablish a connection with Paul. Let's just go ahead and talk about what happened last night, because it was pretty extraordinary last night.
Well, if I were setting odds, I would have to bring Trump's down just a little bit based on yesterday. And that would be due to two events. And that would be the Romney speech and then the debate. And look, here's what I think I saw in those two things. If you were expecting anything to happen in either of those events that would pull support away from Trump, I think you were going to be disappointed. I think both of those events, though, may have gone a good ways toward stiffening the spines of some establishment Republicans who were ready to say, okay, this is going to be our nominee. We need to fall in line behind him and get on with this. And I think both of those occasions showed exactly why he's someone that that you simply can't do that with.
My favorite headline right now on the New York Times website is "A National Descent into Trump's Pants." I just don't look. A debate that in its first 6 minutes goes below the belt. I'm sorry. I mean, when did we get there?
Yeah, we're going to talk about. In fact, we're going to listen to that. What I think is a historic moment in presidential debating in just a couple of minutes. But I understand Paul Krishnamurti's back with us. Hi, do we have better connection this time? Can you hear us better, Paul?
I certainly can, yes. Sounds good.
Now. Wow. That's what you sound like. So, Paul, let me go back to the question I started to ask you. And then I'm going to ask Jim Galloway and Kyle Wingfield from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and Beth Shapiro, our political pollster, to weigh in on this and ask you questions, too. So what happens after a debate last night to the betting markets in the GOP presidential race?
Okay, so as I was explaining, the markets move according to supply and demand, right? There's not one person setting them. They're purely, they move all the plot prices on all of the candidates move 24/7 in real time. Now, according to the markets, as I expected, the two winners last night were Ted Cruz and John Kasich. And Trump is on a negative. He has been for 24 hours.
Interesting. So, and what happened to Donald Trump's odds last night?
Donald Trump has been drifting all week. I think it actually goes back before the debate. It goes back to, first of all, as I've been explaining all week to anyone who will listen, the Super Tuesday results were not as good as they appear at first glance.
Yeah, you wrote in Politico that you felt he underperformed on Super Tuesday.
That's right, I do. I really do think that considerably. And I think that this may be a knock-on effect of the newfound attack last week from Cruz and Rubio and the media scrutiny over the KKK and stuff like that. And he was drifting, and then yesterday when Mitt Romney made that full frontal attack on him, they drifted some more, and today he's even weaker. So he's gone out for the presidency from the peak of around 27% on Tuesday night he's down to about 17% today.
Okay. Paul, let me ask you. You are speaking to a statewide audience of Baptists, with maybe a few Methodists here. They don't always go to casinos. Can you the 27 cents down to 17 cents? Can you explain to us what that really means?
Okay, so there's the way that you would express odds. In traditional terms, would be even 2-1, 3-1. Mm-hmm. Now, all of those odds can be converted into a percentage. And mm-hmm. So the way that I'm explaining this is the total number of percentages for all of the candidates will add up to 100%. So for the next presidency market, the favorite is Hillary Clinton, and she is rated around 63% likely to be president.
Okay.
Trump is second, but he was at 27, now he's dropped to 17, 18.
And those 9 points that he dropped, did they go mostly to Hillary Clinton? Did they go to one of the other Republicans? Was it split?
They've gone to split amongst other Republicans. So Ted Cruz has come in he's got up from about 0.5 to 1% to now he's about 3%. Kasich has come in from 0.5% into about 3%. And Rubio was moved up from about 4 to 6.
So it's interesting, Beth Shapiro, if you're polling the race and you got results that showed Hillary Clinton at 63 and Donald Trump at 17, you'd say, wow, unless something amazing happens, this race is over.
Well, in previous years or in other years, I might say that. But given that this entire election cycle, almost every day something amazing happens, it's hard to sit here now and say, wow, this looks great for whomever, because we have a long way to go until tomorrow, much less November.
Paul, the difference is that when a Beth Shapiro polls, she's looking at 4 or 5 nights in the field, perhaps 3 nights mm-hmm. in the field. You're watching odds change essentially as much as what, hour by hour, right? So you're much more dynamic minute by minute, right?
Yeah. And I think it's also important to not, those percentages, I wouldn't correlate them with opinion poll percentages because they really do transform quickly.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
You can go, you know, if you take Ted Cruz for the nomination, but regardless of the presidency, for the race for the presidency, Ted Cruz at the start of the year was 25%. He went down to 1%, and now he's back up to about 8%, 9%. So it really does fluctuate very, very fast.
So,
and, you know, a 60% favorite is not a certainty at all.
Right, right. Yeah.
So how would you characterize the volatility of this race as expressed in the market, you know, compared to some past U.S. races? Is it more comparable to an election you've seen in another country? How would you compare that to give our listeners an idea of what this looks like?
I think it is more volatile. We have had some volatile cycles, though. So, I mean, my experience of U.S. politics is 2008 and 2012, betting on those ones heavily. In 2012, the Republican nomination was actually very volatile. We had about seven different favourites before Mitt Romney emerged. But it was kind of quite solid after New Hampshire. Once you had a couple of results in the bag, it was obvious Romney was going to be the candidate.
So you haven't had a race that has gone this deep before?
No, absolutely. I mean, normally at this stage you would be looking at a certain winner, and I don't see it that way at all.
So, Paul, thank you for pointing out the difference between the markets and polling, which would be a scientific...
You should only hope there was as much money in polling as there is in markets.
Right. I was in the wrong business all these years. Whereas polling, we know we're talking to a scientific sampling of the voting universe. Can you describe a little bit just who comprises the markets when you talk about the markets?
Well, really, it's anybody. It's anybody who wants to gamble. I mean, fundamentally, it's a British phenomenon. Most of the gamblers, I think, are British because Britain has a very liberalised industry. But having said that, Betfair is a worldwide company, and there's a lot of gamblers from Australia. There's some in the Far East. There's others in Europe. And, you know, the market could consist of people who play in huge numbers, who are always betting thousands. Or it could be just someone who's coming on and having $2 to $3 every time.
Hey, Paul, let me ask you a last question because we're running out of time in the segment. But how are you aware, we know how much attention the campaigns and the candidates pay to the polling that they look at, obviously their own internal polling, but also external polls as well. How are the candidates, what's your sense of how they're paying attention to the betting markets that you're dealing with? Do you hear from campaigns yourself? How are they paying attention to the markets as a reflection of what's going on out there?
It's a great question. Not as much as they should be, or I would like them to be. I'd like them to be retweeting me all the time.
An honest man.
What's your Twitter handle, Paul?
It's at Paul Motti, that's M-O-T-T-Y.
All right, fine. We'll help you with that. But go ahead. Okay. So they're not really talking to you or paying the attention that you think they should.
Not much. Jeb Bush, early in his campaign, did release some kind of ad or flyer which was boasting about how the betting markets made me the favorite, which is a really bad advert for betting markets because it was too early.
Paul Krishnamurti, it's really a pleasure. I'll tell you what, let's stay in touch. And at some point down the road, if we can check back in with you, it would be a great pleasure to do that.
Fantastic. I'd love to do that.
Thanks so much, Paul. You're listening to Political Rewind at 3:20. Why don't we get our first break out of the way and come back and let's talk about that historic moment in last night's Republican presidential debate when one of the candidates bragged about a part of his anatomy that we won't name right now.
You're listening to Political Rewind on Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network. Thank you for joining us. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, offering 55 undergraduate and graduate degree programs in more than 250 fields of study.
Disney's latest female lead is not a princess.
Officer Hawk, I am in pursuit! Woo, woo!
She's a bunny rabbit who's also a cop.
Being tough
and being girly and kind are like mutually exclusive ideas. And Disney, I feel like, threw that out the window.
Actress Jennifer Goodwin on her role in the animated movie Zootopia. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
You're listening to Political Rewind. Kyle Wingfield, Beth Shapiro, and Jim Galloway are here. We're at Politics, GPB, our Twitter handle. TB said, sent us a tweet. I find Trump incredibly coarse, but Rubio's the one that dragged this below the belt with his small hands attack. So why not listen to that historic moment last night?
You know, Brett, let me say something. This campaign for the last year, Donald Trump has basically mocked everybody with personal attacks. He's done so to people that are sitting on the stage today. He's done so about people that are disabled. He's done it about every other candidate in this race. So if there's anyone who's ever deserved to be attacked that way, it's been Donald Trump for the way he's treated people for the last campaign. Now, that said, I would much prefer to have a policy debate. I hope that's what we'll have here tonight. Let's have a policy debate.
And we
will. Talk about Donald Trump's strategy and my strategy and Ted's strategy and John Kasich's strategy when it comes to ISIS and on health care and on the important issues facing this country. But let's be honest, too, about all this. The media has given these personal attacks that Donald Trump has made an incredible amount of coverage. Let's start talking again about the issues that matter to this country. I'm ready to do that starting right here, right now, tonight.
Mr. Trump, your response?
Well, I also happen to call him a lightweight, okay? And I have said that. So I would like to take that back. He's really not that much of a lightweight. And as far as, and I have to say this, he hit my hands. Nobody has ever hit my hands. I've never heard of this one. Look at those hands. Are they small hands? And he referred to my hands. If they're small, something else must be small. I guarantee you there's no problem. I guarantee it. Okay. Moving on.
Jim Galloway, what is happening to us?
Reality TV? I don't know. The real presidential candidates of Atlanta? You know, I've had so many people come up to me and say, "Look, I can't have my kids watch this stuff anymore."
Yeah, yeah. Beth, what is it? I mean, this locker room back and forth is bad enough. I mean, here we are; you're the only woman in this room today. I would think it's offensive to all of us, but I would think women out there, women voters who are watching this kind of stuff unfold. I can't help but wonder what they're thinking about, what you're thinking about.
I think in this case the appalled reaction crosses gender lines. I just think it's really hard for most of us to watch this and think this is one of the two major political parties in the country and this is how their debate starts. And how the debate started last night is a continuation of what's been happening the last couple of debates. It's like watching schoolyard fights. I used to teach elementary school way back when, and if the three of those four guys had been in my class, I would have put them in different corners for long timeouts. It's sad to see what these debates have come to.
So, Kyle, now's a good time to go back and let you reframe the point that you made at the very beginning while we were waiting to get Paul, Christian Birdie, back on the phone. Give us your take on what you saw unfold after that and the rest of this debate.
Well, I think if you were not a Trump supporter, but you were thinking, okay, it's about time to hold my nose, get in line, get on the bandwagon, however you want to put it. Between Mitt Romney's speech yesterday, where he just laid out what a complete phony and hypocrite Donald Trump is for all the issues that he has brought up and how he's been right at the center, at the heart of the problem on so many of them. And then you watch this last night and you realize, you know, we didn't start this campaign with Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz acting this way. They have done this as a response to Trump.
It's the Trumpification of presidential politics.
It's the only way you can actually get him to engage. And it's the only way you can make him look as small as he is. And I mean that as in terms of a person here.
Not his hands.
Yes, not his hands. I'm not talking about his hands. It just what a what a lightweight, to use one of his words, he is when it comes to policy. Because when you talk about policy, whatever thought happens to come into his mind at that time is what he's going to say, and you can't pin him down on what he said before. You can't pin him down on how he would go about these things. And so it's kind of become jungle rules
politics.
So
is it a terrible dilemma for them, Jim? Because Rubio and Cruz, Rubio especially last night, didn't do himself any favors.
They're in this huge box, and I can't see a way out for them. And quite frankly, Mitt Romney only emphasized the box when he came out and spoke Thursday. First of all, I mean, you have to just, you know, a little caveat here. Mitt Romney is the guy who sought Donald Trump's endorsement when he was still a birther back in 2012.
And Trump made a rather vulgar
absolutely
comparison or, you know, reference on that.
Yeah, Trump said, he came to me, pleaded for my endorsement. If I had told him to get down on his knees, he would have done it. Again, going into this.
I think that I agree with Kyle's point to some extent that Cruz and Rubio did have to go after him. I disagree with how they did it. They didn't need to get into the schoolyard. Rubio especially. I think that he really has hurt his brand. He comes across as being very young to begin with, and acting as childlike as Trump doesn't help him. I think that the two of them could have much earlier in this process begun to hit Trump on policy. And the two of them are very glib. They're very good debaters. I think they could have gotten under his skin on policy and not had to go, Rubio especially, not had to go where they've gone with him.
But back to Romney, what he outlined on Thursday was essentially a tag team approach to Donald Trump. Nobody wins, but if you're in Florida, vote for Rubio. Over Trump. If you're in Ohio, vote for Kasich over Trump. If you're in anywhere that Cruz is strong, vote for him over Trump. It's not that's a Vietnam of a formula right there.
Well, and if one of the candidates got down in the mud with Trump the most last night, it was clearly Rubio. Yeah. And some of the speculation you saw after Super Tuesday was. And there are debates both ways on this, but that Cruz is in the stronger position to be a top-of-the-ticket competition for Trump, and that a Cruz-Rubio in that order, unity ticket, might be the only thing that can get the Republicans out of this mess. And you saw Rubio engage much more in that kind of attack. And I thought vice presidential role. Absolutely.
Yeah,
that's exactly
Let's,
what I thought.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because it certainly was, as we heard in that exchange, Rubio and Trump going at each other like children in a schoolyard. But, you know, at Cruz actually did bring up some issues that have the potential to hurt Trump that could make him vulnerable. Let's listen to that one of those attacks.
If you don't like Obamacare, Donald Trump funded Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi taking over Congress to pass Obamacare. On immigration, if you don't like amnesty, if you don't like the Gang of Eight, Donald Trump funded five of the eight members of the Gang of Eight, $50,000. And let's talk about this election. The choice Republican primary voters are making is who is best prepared to stand up to Hillary Clinton and beat Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump has written checks to Hillary Clinton not once, not twice, not three times, 10 times, and four of those checks were not to her Senate campaign. It wasn't that she was the New York senator and it was a cost of doing business. It was to her presidential campaign.
It was for business. I pride myself, including outside of the United States. I'm doing...
So, Beth, that's kind of fertile ground, perhaps, as you move forward in this to go after Trump, yes?
It is fertile ground, but here's the problem the Republicans have. You had Mitt Romney laying out a very well thought out, very cogent a brief against Donald Trump and why he would be such a terrible president. You had his three opponents attacking him, or two of his opponents, Kasich remaining above the fray, but two of his three opponents attacking him as hard as they could and with some very compelling arguments against him. But then you come to the end of the evening and these three opponents are asked, if will you support the eventual nominee of the party? And every one of them raises his hand and says, yes, I will. So they completely step on their own message at the end of the evening.
And that box was created when? That was back in September, August? August.
When it was a trap August? For Trump to try to deal with. Would you exactly. support the party? And now it's back haunting the other guys.
Caught in their own trap.
Yeah. So let's expand on that just a little bit here. Jim, you wrote a column the other day. Let's talk a little bit about it from the Georgia perspective. And the first thing I'd ask you about that is, we always like to look at this through a Georgia filter. Do you think the Georgia voters who were watching that debate last night had any reason to change their allegiance and the votes that they cast just two nights earlier than that? Or is everything status quo?
I think it's all status quo.
Kyle?
I don't think Donald Trump showed us nothing new, just a little bit more of himself than we're used to.
Yesterday was not about peeling away from that number. It was about keeping it from getting any bigger. And I think that was probably achieved. But now it's a temporary victory, and it's got to be held.
So that's where we get to the point that I really was hoping to get into, because the two of you had interesting columns this week that were sort of that ran counter to one another. There, it was an interesting sort of debate without you being side by side. Kyle, you argued this week that this race is not over at all. There's still a path to victory based on delegate apportionment for another candidate. Talk a little bit about that.
That's right. I mean, if you look at where we are in this stage of the race and compare it to the past few contested primaries that we've had in the Republican Party, Trump is by far the weakest front runner at this stage there has been. He went from before Tuesday having a little over 60% of the delegates, 62%, I think, to after Tuesday being at 46%. He's off pace to clinch the nomination at this point. Now, yes, the race changes on March 15th with winner-take-all states. And, either way, all hinges on those states. But Mitt Romney was in the 60s at this point. John McCain was at 58%. George Bush in 2000 was at 71%. And here you've got Trump at 46%. So the field remains more fractured. And I just believe that there is a way, maybe not for one of the other candidates to win it outright, but to take it to a convention.
All right. Before we get to Jim's column, Beth, let me just say real quickly. So Kyle's pointing out that you could say that Donald Trump, certainly in Georgia as an example, probably underperformed on Tuesday. I mean, he won, and he won six states other than Georgia. But he got 39% of the vote here. He did not stop Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz from crossing the 20% threshold that allowed each of them to take delegates out of Georgia. So that really does sort of suggest that Kyle's point is really something we ought to be paying attention to.
Oh, I think it is.
All right. So, Jim, you had a slightly different point because you talked to Randy Evans, one of the real luminaries of national Republican politics, who's here in Atlanta.
A confidant of Newt Gingrich and a veteran of conducting many rebellions.
Right. And you said, and your column's point was, don't look at the delegates, essentially look at the emotion.
It's not the math that matters, it's the momentum. And this was Randy Evans's point, and you saw it come across in Mitt Romney's speech too. What Randy Evans was saying, it's look, if Donald Trump does nothing but get 40% from here on out in race after race after race, it doesn't matter if at the end of in mid June he has a majority, he will be seen as inevitable. So if you're going to stop Trump, what you have to do is you have to rob him of that cloak of inevitability. And in order to do that, he has to start losing states.
And March 15th is going to be the big one. I mean, we've got on March 8th, we don't want to forget, we've got Michigan's a big state. It was bigger when John Kasich was saying that he might be able to win it. He now pretty well concedes that's not likely to happen. But March 15th, Beth, we've got Ohio voting, Kasich's home state. We got Florida, the big one, because if Rubio can't win there, what the heck happens next.
Well, and he's losing it.
Yeah, he's losing
what's
badly.
What's so fascinating about this, and coming back to Romney's speech, is that he was essentially conceding, we don't have a plan B, that no one of these three opponents is strong enough that the party will coalesce around him. And it was, okay, in Ohio, vote for Kasich, and in Florida, vote for Rubio, and somewhere else, vote for Cruz. But let's get ourselves into a contested convention, and then we can watch all heck break loose. We'll keep this G-rated.
I think part of it comes down to, what are you playing for? Are you playing for winning in November, or are you playing for the long-term future of the party? If you're playing for winning in November, then your best bet probably is to acknowledge the momentum of Donald Trump and to see him through that election. The problem is, if you're worried about the long-term future of the party, you're maybe hoping that he loses that election, because if he is the winner and he is a Republican president and he comes to be seen as the face of what Republicans are, at the Capitol every day, I have establishment Georgia Republicans come up to me and say, I've been working 10, 20, 30, 40 years building this party, and I don't want to have anything to do with Donald Trump. He is not the representative of this party I've been trying to build. And so if you're thinking with that long term of perspective about the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, then I think you say, we'll go to Cleveland. We'll stop him at all costs. Yeah, we'll lose the election. At this point, we're probably going to lose it anyway, but we can salvage something resembling what we've thought it meant to be a Republican.
I mean, can you imagine going to Cleveland and dismissing 40% of the people who walk in there?
By trying to take the nomination away
from
him.
You, exactly. But if it's 40%, you're dismissing 60%. Who said no?
Why you don't think there's a winning proposition here.
I increasingly think that the mere existence and success thus far of Donald Trump is pretty much handing the election to Hillary Clinton.
All right, so this brings us back, I think, Jim, to the you pointed it out that, or maybe it was you, Kyle. I'm sorry, but this last question last night: will you support the eventual nominee? Now, that's an inevitable question, it seems to me, that you could have prepared for as you're doing your debate prep. Your advisors could have said, hey, when they ask you that, there had to be a more nuanced answer if you're a Marco Rubio who spent almost 2 hours attacking Donald Trump, Ted Cruz attacking him. There had to be some way. I mean, I'm not a politician. I could have figured out a way to spin that so that I didn't have to come out and say, of course.
No, yeah. I mean, you've had in the last 48 hours, you've had Ted Cruz say that Donald Trump would be a disaster for the country, not for the party, for the country. You've had Romney say Trump will be a disaster, not for the party, for the country. And then yet you had this morning Marco Rubio, when he's pressed on that very question, saying, oh, well, Hillary will be worse. That's not selling.
Yeah, you've got to hand it to the moderators who did a great job, and I'm not normally
Fox News has done a great job on these
Fox
debates.
News people, but I think they did a great job of herding cats. And that question, I forget who it was who asked it, but the questioner kept saying yes or no, and for three pretty glib people who can talk their way out of lots of questions, They pretty much fell in line with the yes no.
Yeah, the closest any of them came was John Kasich saying, "Well, look, I kind of expect to be the nominee myself," but he was pressed and he eventually. But I mean, honestly, I don't know what else they could say
right
at this point.
Well, I will tell you, we hit Johnny Isaacson up with that question a while ago, and his nuanced answer was, "I will support the nominee." But enthusiasm varies with that nominee.
Yeah, and there's always that answer that, I'm supporting the nominee, but I just may find a reason to stay home on election day.
Yeah, Herman Talmadge always went fishing.
Yeah, so. Yeah. All right, so let's take one more step. By the way, we're at PoliticsGPB, our Twitter handle, and we just got a tweet from Dickie McGee who says, it is silly how the candidates are acting. I would expect more from a college student than I would men of their age. I think there's pretty unanimous agreement about that. All right, so we talk about this brokered convention notion, and you know, and what chaos we might see in Cleveland in July. And that got me thinking, because I'm old enough to remember, the 1964 Republican Convention in San Francisco. That's the Goldwater Convention, the conservative Barry Goldwater, the very conservative Barry Goldwater, who voted against the Civil Rights Bill, and who also had suggested at one point that perhaps tactical nuclear weapons would be a good option to use in Vietnam. And the conservative wing of the Republican Party took over to make him the nominee. But it was a chaotic convention for a while. And I thought it'd be kind of interesting to go back. Nelson Rockefeller was the Mitt Romney of that convention, right, Jim Galloway?
Right.
The mainstream establishment Republican.
But one of his lieutenants was
George Romney.
Yes.
Mitt's dad. So let's listen a little excerpt when Nelson Rockefeller, that great liberal Republican from New York, got up and tried to knock some sense, he thought, into the crowd.
These extremists feed on fear, hate, and terror. They encourage disunity. These are people who have nothing in common with Americanism. The Republican Party must repudiate these people.
So, Kyle Wingfield, sound familiar?
Yeah, I guess we'll be asked to refudiate some of them now with the new word that Sarah Palin added to our vocabulary a few years ago. You know, I guess this is Trump represents something of a revolution to the revolution, which in most mainstream Republicans' minds is still going on, is unfinished, is incomplete. And I will be shocked if we see the Republican Party realign in a way that Trump has set, in the way that it did, with Goldwater.
I had not thought of this.
That's a scary thought.
Donald Trump is Robespierre.
All right. So we do want to make, I do think there's a distinction, Beth Shapiro. 1964, the lines were drawn ideologically. Conservatives versus moderate Republicans. That's really not what we're watching unfold in the Republican Party today, really. This isn't ideology. This is about the outsiders who are filled with anger and hostility.
This is anti-ideology.
Right, exactly.
Well, except the only thing I'd say against that is the people that you see standing up the most firmly to Trump and the most firmly saying, never Trump, you know, hashtag never Trump all over Twitter, you see, are conservative movement people.
Especially your religious conservatives.
Right. You're seeing the Bill Kristols and Weekly Standard. You're seeing the folks at National Review. You're seeing people who are movement conservatives first and Republicans second. So there is an ideological element to it. However, it's not as if Trump's proposing a counter ideology. He's just
Trump.
He's just him.
Well, if you look at the exit polling, which of course political junkies do, what you see is that the one of the primary reasons that people support Trump is because he tells it like it is. Policy almost doesn't matter. He's articulating a deep sense of anger and frustration that his supporters are feeling, and he's telling it like it is.
Just to round out before we break that 64 convention, little item there that we played. A couple days after Nelson Rockefeller made that speech, Thursday night, it was a chance for Barry Goldwater as the nominee to give his acceptance speech, introduced, by the way, lest we forget, by Richard M. Nixon, who praised him to the heavens. And then Barry Goldwater made his speech, and included in that speech were a couple of the most famous lines in 20th century politics.
And let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
We got one more part of that, because he went on to say, and he said both of those things. Extremism is no vice, and moderation is no virtue. Yeah. Okay, I lost that in my headset, so I apologize for that. Tell you what, by the way, he got clobbered in the general election. Republicans all over the country went up in flames because of Barry Goldwater, and there are people who fear the same thing could happen.
But he took a few southern states, and that was the beginning.
He took Georgia. One of the states he took was Georgia.
And that was the beginning.
And I, oddly, and I don't think this is likely to happen to Donald Trump, in the years that followed, he became one of the most revered and respected leaders of the conservative movement. People ended up thinking that Barry Goldwater was a great man of the United States Senate, right?
Well, I think a lot of Republicans feel that he laid the groundwork for Ronald Reagan to follow eventually. And obviously, Republicans have not found another Reagan-esque figure that they revere. You don't hear them talk about either of the Bushes in that way or anyone else since then. I mean, Nixon or Ford or anybody. It's Reagan, Reagan, Reagan.
But now we have the children of the Reagan Revolution who are running.
Exactly. Case in point.
All right. We're going to take our final break because when we come back, we have a really, I think, a compelling state story to talk about. Governor Deal the other day held a news avail, and he made some comments about religious liberty that I think I know struck Jim Galloway as very meaningful. Me too, when I heard them. I'm sure it's true around this table. So let's listen to that when we get back. But for now, it's 3:47 on Friday afternoon. You're listening to Political Rewind.
There are so many news sources competing for your attention.
You try to lift up the name of Christ in any public forum, and what happens? The lawyers come and say, we're going to sue you. And so people begin to back up. People go, oh, I don't want to get sued. Let me tell you, get sued.
You're looking for more than sound bites. You want context that explains how the headlines affect you. Listen weekdays to Morning Edition from 5 to 9 a.m. and to All Things Considered from 4 to 7 p.m. on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Kyle Wingfield, Beth Shapiro, and Jim Galloway are with me. Fig and Thistle sent us a tweet at PoliticsGPB. Why are you discounting Bernie Sanders? This race, certainly not between the Republicans and Clinton. You know, but the GOP has put the Democratic race far out of the headlines, at least this week, right, Jim?
Oh, yeah. Look, Hillary very much cleaned up in the South on Super Tuesday. I don't know what the delegate spread is, but it's moving deeper into states where Sanders has less and less of a chance.
And she also took Massachusetts, which I think was an important state for her to win to prove that her appeal is in some of the places where people thought that Sanders would win.
All right, let's turn to state politics. Jim, let me give you a chance to set this up. We've talked about it before. I don't know how in much detail we want to go, but the legislature is still wrestling with which version of a religious liberty bill, if any, to adopt.
Right. The House passed a Pastor Protection Act, which was just a very innocuous, everybody can marry whoever they want to bill. It reaffirmed the First Amendment, if you will. Went to the Senate. The Senate tacked on what's known as the First Amendment Defense Act, which gave specific protections to people who wanted to shun other people based on their marital status. It didn't matter what they thought of the marital, whether it was same-sex, polygamy, traditional marriage. If they wanted to shun someone because of their thoughts on marriage, they could do it.
So
it's a bill just begging for a lawsuit.
So the Pastor Protection Act was one that Speaker Ralston thought might be able to be used to satisfy the Republican legislators going home to tell their people, yes, I did something about gay marriage,
and would support a court challenge.
Right. And then Greg Kirk's First Amendment Defense Act is much more aggressive, as you've pointed out. And that's now what the House has been handed, is this bill with the Greg Kirk amendment. So we've all been waiting to see how this is going to unfold. And the other day, the governor talked to a number of reporters. The AJC's Greg Bluestein was there, and he and Jim were very nice to share with us a portion of what Nathan Deal said. And I'm going to play out just a little longer segment because I think it's a very, very compelling statement. Let's listen.
We do not have a belief in my way of looking at religion that says that we have to discriminate against anybody. If you were to apply those standards to the teachings of Jesus, I don't think they fit. Why, for example, would he reach out to the woman at the well? She was an outcast because of her social mores, and she was being rejected. She had to come in the heat of the day because she couldn't come when the rest of the women came to the well to draw their water. I think what that says is that he says that we have a belief in forgiveness and that we do not have to discriminate unduly against anyone on the basis of our own religious beliefs. I do not feel threatened by the fact that people who might choose same-sex marriages pursue that route. Sandra and I are looking forward to, in June, celebrating our 50th wedding anniversary. And true, we are traditional marriage people. We believe the importance of that. But that does not mean that those who hold to that view should feel like that they are threatened by those who have a different point of view. I hope that we can all just take a deep breath, recognize that the world is changing around us, and recognize that it is important that we protect fundamental religious beliefs, but we don't have to discriminate against other people in order to do that. And that's the compromise that I'm looking for.
So that's Governor Nathan Deal. We're going to talk about the political implications of what he said in just a moment. Beth, I find Nathan Deal continually surprising. There are times when he seems to hew to a conservative line that a lot of people get upset about. His feeling that we shouldn't allow Syrian refugees in the country disturbed a number of people. A few years back, his immigration legislation was distressing to some people. But every now and then he comes along with a statement like this that makes you recognize there's a lot more inside this man than we sometimes give him credit for, including, by the way, his criminal justice reforms.
I think it was a very impressive statement. I think it was an important moment for him, for all of Georgia. But if you go back to the end of June, the weekend that the ruling came down from the Supreme Court that legalized marriage for all people in the country, Governor Deal and Attorney General Olins pretty much said, this is the law of the land, Georgia obeys the law of the land. So early on, he set a tone for, we're part of the United States, we're not Alabama, we accept what the Supreme Court has handed down. And I think that what was so important about what he said this week was that there's been tremendous business opposition to the bill that came out of the Senate in particular, or the component that was added in the Senate, because of the legitimate fear of the impact on the economy in Georgia. I think what was important about what the governor said was that he put it in biblical terms, in religious terms, and I think that's speaking to the people who are the most upset about this, and speaking in a way that I hope, and I'm not one of those people, but I hope is not as perhaps as offensive to them as putting it in the realm of economy.
Right. No, but when you bring in the New Testament, you have staked a position. And I think that's one thing that the governor did there. The other thing that he also did was, and I don't think it was picked up in the audio there, was that he said he doesn't have to have a bill. He's entirely willing to walk away from this. And that's a negotiating position. That means you accept my strictures, or I simply walk away and we don't do anything.
Kyle, we're hearing, I know you've heard this, Jim, I've been getting some information out there. The governor is involved in trying to come up with a compromise that they hope will satisfy everybody on this thing. Yes?
Yeah. I have yet to hear anyone think that they know what that compromise will be. And I don't think it's the normal, you know, kabuki or holding things close to the vest. I think the best I can tell, they truly don't know yet what they can do that will resolve the situation in a way that doesn't end up with one side or the other just blowing up at it.
So we had Senator Greg Kirk on Lawmakers the other night, and I asked him point blank in the end of the show, what if you come away with only pastor protection, Senator? Will you and Josh McCoon and the others who've been on your side of this be satisfied? He said, absolutely not. But Jim, it does look like pastor protection and then a couple of added layers of other things might be brought into
maybe,
the mix.
Maybe, you know, if I were a betting man, I would say you'd have the pastor's protection aspect of this, and then just a straight-up adoption of the federal RFRA law, and then possibly, if they're feeling like they've got their oats, maybe a civil rights bill that includes LGBT.
Yeah,
and that's the missing piece is that Senator McCoon and others like to say that, well, this is just imitating the federal RFRA law. But what the other half that he neglects to tell us is that Georgia has no legal protection against discrimination in employment, housing, et cetera, to protect LGBT citizens.
And we had a bill, Rich Golick had a bill, which would...
You've got a Rich Golick bill that has the civil rights protection, although it does not include an LGBT aspect to it. And then you have an Ed Setzler, a Republican out of Ackworth, who's got the RFRA legislation. So the pieces are out there. It's just whether they're going to be assembled or not.
I think Kyle had a great suggestion in your column about a month or so ago, and he noted that for the people who want some type of RFRA, that if you get it wrong this time, you're not going to have a chance to come back and get it right, and that there do seem to be people on both sides of the issue that are ready to talk, and perhaps it's time for a study committee, which is in the works, I think, to take some time and really try to figure out how to do this right.
It can't be only that, because you've got to take some of the steam out of this issue. I think you've got to make some progress, and I think on both fronts, toward something concrete upon which other future steps can be built. But going much beyond what Jim described is just can't be done.
All right, we're going to have to park the conversation. Well, next Wednesday, Political Rewind, 2 o'clock, we'll talk more about this, I'm certain. But I want to take just a minute here. You know, as journalists, there are tragedies that we witness, that we see, and that make us feel bad, but we understand they're not really affecting us in a completely personal way. Not long ago, a couple of weeks back, we read about Tamari Jackson, the young man who went on a trip with his class.
To Belize.
Belize.
He was from North Cobb High School.
And he drowned. And he apparently was a very beloved member of his class. He was just over 15 years old. And I got a package in the mail from David Chastain, one of the members of the Cobb County School Board. And he said to me that Tamari Jackson had been a fan of Political Rewind, and he sent me the memorial program. And in there it says, of late, Tamari developed a strong interest in politics and listened to Political Rewind on GPB radio. He also had asked his mom to get him a copy of the Jane Meyer book, Dark Money. That personalizes this in a way I never would have expected it to. So I just, Jim, your daughter is up there.
Right. My daughter Carol Galloway is an AP teacher up at North Cobb. She says the whole school's heartbroken. It's just a terrible situation.
Well, Tamari, I only wish you could be listening to us as we move forward in this election year. We're so sorry to the family for your loss. Kyle Wingfield, Beth Shapiro, Jim Galloway, thank you so much for being here on a day after one of the most tumultuous debates we've ever seen in politics. I'm Bill Nigut. I'll be back again next Wednesday at 2 with another edition of Political Rewind.